not in a good way. You're signing a form that will permit me to set up an IALTA account. What does that mean anyway? Judy signed the second form. An interest-only lawyer's trust account. It's a clunky acronym for holding account. That's all. Any fund generates interest, and the question is where the interest goes and who owns it. Why didn't they just say that? Because they're politicians. Judy finished signing the forms and handed him back the pen, which he returned to his breast pocket. Under the statute, the interest flows into a general fund used to improve access to the civil legal system. That's nice, isn't it? We need the money in a safe place while we set up the estate, which will take some time to do. If we could open an estate in a day, then we wouldn't need the IALTA account. I understand. Judy liked that John said we, as if her problem was his problem, too. If the money is put in an IALTA account, there is no need to identify the owner to the bank. That works well in this situation, since we don't know who the rightful owner is. Right. Just so we're clear, the decedent was a Pennsylvania resident, correct? Yes, but she was undocumented. That doesn't matter, for present purposes. As a Pennsylvania resident, her estate administration is governed by the Pennsylvania Estate and Fiduciary Code. You remember the basics from law school? The jurisdiction was different, but the legal fundamentals remain the same. No, I sucked at trusts and estates. I know you did. I remember, John chuckled, and so did Judy. Anyway, the PEF code gives a priority list of persons entitled to administer an estate. There is no will, I presume? Not as far as I know. We can talk later about the larger questions regarding the administration of the estate, when you have more time. I wanted to make sure we were on the same page. John extended his hand, palm up. May I have your driver's license, please? I need ID to set up the account, then I can let you go on your way. Thanks. Judy went into her purse, extracted her driver's license from her wallet, and handed it to him. Great. John slid out his iPhone, took a picture of her driver's license, and handed it back to her. So now the money's in your hands. It's more complicated than that, but I can explain it to you later. These funds are considered qualified funds under the Code of Professional Responsibility. Okay, Judy said, as she could tell from the authoritative tone in his voice that he knew what he was talking about, and she didn't have time to find out. I should be getting to the hospital. My aunt's pretty sick. I'm sorry to hear that. John frowned slightly, with genuine sympathy in his eyes. It would be gentlemanly of me to walk you to the elevator, but there are 50,000 reasons I should stay right here. I agree. Judy smiled, and John smiled back, meeting her eye more directly than was professional. Why don't you call me tonight or tomorrow and we can set up a time to talk about the next steps? It's a fairly involved process getting you or your aunt appointed as the administrator of the estate. Really? Why? Judy asked, going to the threshold of his office. The world isn't set up for $50,000 that nobody wants to keep. It's not easy to do the right thing. No, it's not easy to do the legal thing. John tilted his chin up, smiling. I admire your aunt. So do I, Judy said, feeling her emotions well up. Well, I'd better go. Thanks so much. Bye now. Call me. I will, thanks. Judy left the office and hustled down the hall through the reception room, down the elevator and out the lobby to the street, where the cab driver was still waiting. She climbed in the cab and slammed the door behind her. Thanks for hanging in. No problem. Where to? The hospital, please. You got it. They took off, switching lanes in traffic, and Judy's head was swimming. She slid out her phone and checked to see if her mother had called or texted, but she hadn't. She checked her email reflexively and noticed that new email had popped onto the screen. It was an official filing from the United States District Court, which permitted electronic filing in motions and cases, so it had to be something important. She opened the email concerned. Motion for sanctions against plaintiff's counsel, Judy Carrier, Esquire, pursuant to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 37, read the title of the motion. And the caption of the action was Linda Adler versus Penn Bank. The motion had been filed on behalf of Penn Bank by Rick Kellen. What? Judy gasped, aghast. Her heart sank as she skimmed the first few lines. Move-in Penn Bank asked the court to sanction plaintiff's counsel, Judy Carrier, Esquire, for failure to cooperate in discovery, i.e., for inappropriate and abusive misconduct during the deposition of witness Mr. Devi Govinda. Judy couldn't believe what she was reading. Rule 37 was an extreme remedy, a last resort for when the discovery process was being obstructed, blocked, or the like. She had never seen it used the way Kellen was using it against her. She read on. Plaintiff's counsel badgered and harassed the witness. Plaintiff's counsel threatened that she would get the witness at trial. Plaintiff's counsel left defense counsel no alternative but to flee the deposition in order to protect the shaken witness from further distress. The cab veered around the corner, and Judy scrolled through the motion, which was short, only 2 pages long. That must have been how Kellen had gotten it written and filed so quickly. Either that, or he had it already on a form. She turned to the last page, which was a certification signed by counsel that he had attempted to confer in an effort to settle the dispute. At the bottom of the page was Richard Kellen's signature. After, defense counsel called plaintiff's counsel and attempted to discuss this matter with her today to no avail. Plaintiff's counsel rudely cut off the conversation, then hung up on defense counsel. Defense counsel cannot subject witness Philip Burrell to plaintiff's counsel until this court has ruled. Judy shook her head, disgusted. She understood what Kellen was up to, and she kicked herself for leaving herself vulnerable. He wouldn't win the motion, but he'd bring her conduct to the attention of the court, prejudicing the judge against her. She'd have to file a reply explaining herself, but the judge's first impression of her would be as a hothead. She had to hope it wouldn't prejudice him against Linda's case, or she'd never forgive herself. Judy gritted her teeth, jostling in the moving cab. She had misjudged Kellen as a spoiled baby, but he was a sharp and aggressive litigator. His motion was typical of the behind-the-scenes gamesmanship that she hated, but she had no one but herself to blame. Her thoughts raced ahead, and the implications fell like dominoes in a cause-and-effect chain of collapse. She'd have to write, research, and file a response to the motion right away to mitigate the damage with the judge. She'd have to get the Morrell deposition rescheduled. She'd have to explain it to Linda and, worse, to Benny. The cab raced toward the hospital, and Judy looked to the window, realizing that as bad as it was, it paled in comparison to what Aunt Barb was going through this very minute. Chapter 27. So what did the nurse say? Judy asked, dumping her messenger bag and purse on the chair next to her mother in the quiet waiting room. A young receptionist sat at the front desk, tapping on the computer keyboard, and the only other people were an older couple sitting together at the far end of the row, watching the news on a TV mounted in the corner with closed captioning. She hasn't said anything new since what I told you on the phone. What about why it was taking longer? Judy slid out of her coat and put it on top of her stuff. Did you ask why? Yes, and she said she didn't know, but she'd keep us posted. Her mother pursed her lips, lipsticked a tasteful pink, which told Judy that she had just been in the bathroom freshening her makeup. So that conversation was at about 10:30, correct? Yes, I suppose so, if I'm to be cross-examined. Her mother gestured at the empty chair beside her. Please, have a seat. Judy checked her watch, which showed 12:01. So that was an hour and a half ago. I can subtract, dear. Sit down. Hold on. Judy hovered over her chair and glanced back at the receptionist. I'm saying because it's been an hour and a half, so it seems reasonable to ask how things are going. Don't ask any more questions. If there's something we need to know, they'll tell us. Judy almost laughed out loud. Mom, I'm a lawyer. If I ran my life that way, I'd be out of a job. Do you have to be a lawyer every minute? Honestly, yes. You're not in a courtroom. You're in a hospital. So what? I don't think it's a bad thing to be a lawyer in a hospital. I do. I don't, Judy shot back defensive. It's good to be an advocate when you're in a hospital. Aunt Barb can't do this herself, so she needs us to be her advocate. Oh, for goodness sake, sit down. Judy glanced back at the receptionist, who was now on the phone. What's the big deal? I can't go ask a question? She's just a receptionist. She's not a nurse. She doesn't know anything. Her mother inhaled slowly, which Judy recognized as her long-suffering martyr sound. She can find it out, Mom. That's not how it works. The doctor comes out and talks to you, or the nurse. The receptionist doesn't tell you anything. Her mother brushed a hair back into its silky blonde top knot, a reflexive gesture since every strand was in place. That doesn't mean you can't ask. But what's the point? Her mother asked sharply. The point is that I'm worried something happened. Judy raised her voice, not bothering to check herself. She couldn't shake the stress of the morning, the botched deposition, or the Rule 37 motion. Don't you want to know what's going on in there? She's your sister. No, I don't want to know, her mother rolled her eyes. She's my own sister, but I don't care. You're the only one who cares. Thank God you've arrived. Mom, really? That must be it. You love her more than I do. To prove it, you'll go running around willy-nilly asking questions that nobody will answer. Judy felt her temper give way. Mom, what's your problem? That's not what I'm going to do at all, and you can't know if somebody won't answer a question until you ask. Then go ask, her mother hissed, her blue eyes flashing with anger, her fair skin flushed under her foundation. Why are you bothering me? You're a big girl. You're a lawyer. 24/7. If there isn't a fight, you'll pick one. You'll find one. You're not happy unless you're unhappy. Her mother threw a hand toward the reception desk, then turned away. Go ask whatever questions you want. You don't need my permission. God knows you never listen to me anyway. Stung, Judy pivoted on her heel and charged toward the front desk, where the receptionist was hanging up the phone. Excuse me, I was wondering. Yes, I just got word that your aunt is out of surgery. She's being taken to the recovery room now, and you'll be able to see her when she wakes up.
Great.
Judy felt tears of relief, or maybe frustration, come to her eyes, but she blinked them away. When will that be? It's usually an hour or more. Do you know why it took longer? No, I don't. Is that typical or atypical? Judy asked, without knowing exactly why. Maybe she wanted to know what to expect when she saw her aunt. Maybe she didn't trust the hospital to be forthcoming about anything that had gone wrong. Or maybe her mother was right, that if there wasn't a fight, she'd pick one. I don't know, I'm just a receptionist, not a nurse. The receptionist's dark eyes shifted towards Judy's mother and back again, and Judy felt embarrassed that the receptionist had overheard her mother's comment. Sorry about that. No apologies are necessary. The receptionist looked away. Unfortunately, the doctor was called in on another operation, and so he won't be able to speak with you yet. The schedule's running behind, and he'll meet you in the recovery room just as soon as he can. He'll be able to answer your questions at that time. I can have a nurse come out and give you an update momentarily. I would like that. Thank you very much. Thank you. Judy walked stiffly back to the row of chairs against the wall, and sat down next to her mother, who turned away, fake reading an old copy of People. "She's fine, and the nurse will see us." "I heard," her mother said, without looking up from the magazine. And Judy turned in the opposite direction and reached for her laptop to get started on a response to the Rule 37 motion. Mother and daughter sat stiffly side by side for the next 15 minutes, until a cheery nurse in a blue scrub cap and patterned scrubs emerged from the door behind the reception desk and made a beeline for them.
"Miss Carrier?" asked the nurse.
As she approached, a blue lanyard bearing her hospital ID bounced on her ample bosom. "Yes," her mother answered, looking up. "That's us." Judy took her laptop off her lap and stood up to meet the nurse, who touched her arm with a friendly, reassuring smile.
"I have good news, ladies."
"Thank God." Judy eased back down in her chair, awash in a warm wave of gratitude, as the nurse explained that Aunt Barb's surgery had been successful, but they were still waiting on further pathology tests of her tissue. The nurse said that she didn't know why it took longer, but that wasn't atypical, and she promised that the doctor would fill them in the recovery room once Aunt Barb woke up. Judy's mother asked about the pain medication, which was Vicodin, and the drains, which seemed to preoccupy her, but Judy felt increasingly too emotional to bother with the medical details. She barely listened to her mother and the nurse talking about the emptying and stripping of drains. She was just happy Aunt Barb had come through her surgery. "Well, that's a relief," her mother said after the nurse had left, then returned to her magazine.
"I know."
Judy felt the urge to hug her mother, who was evidently memorizing the magazine.
"I'm sorry if I was short with you, Mom. I was just upset."
"We both were," her mother answered without looking up, then lapsed into silence. Judy didn't know whether her mother officially wasn't speaking to her and let it go. She picked up her laptop, turned her attention to the Rule 37 motion, and tried to draft coherent sentences, writing that she hadn't been abusive during Govinda's deposition, hadn't forced the witness or his lawyer to leave, and hadn't intentionally hung up on Kellen, but that the conversation had been accidentally terminated by an incoming call, which, she explained, only as a family emergency. She'd be damned if she'd trade Aunt Barb's privacy to win the motion, or for any other reason. 1 hour stretched into two, as Judy worked, keeping an eye on her laptop clock and wondering why Aunt Barb was taking so long to wake up. She finalized the motion, filed it electronically with the court, then checked her email, which was piling up, and her phone messages, which would have to wait. Frank had texted her, "How's Aunt Barb?" And she texted back, "Still waiting to hear the details, but it went okay. Thanks. XOXO. She thought briefly of John and felt reassured that the money was safe. Even if its ownership caused problems, they'd have to resolve down the line. Finally, the nurse reappeared and escorted Judy and her mother to the recovery room, where Aunt Barb lay sleeping in a hospital bed, her head to the side, still in her plastic cap. Layers of cotton blankets covered her to her shoulders, and oddly, an IV port was stuck in the side of her neck, as well as the top of her hand. Her skin had a gravely ashy hue, and her eyelids barely fluttered open when Judy and her mother took their places on opposite sides of her bed. "Is she okay?" Judy asked the nurse, alarmed as she set her stuff down on a chair. "She looks pale."
"She's fine."
The nurse closed the patterned curtain around them, giving them some privacy.
"She's had something to drink, but she's sleepy. We gave her something for nausea, and you can expect her to have a dry throat from the intubation. She'll be in and out of sleep for the next hour or two until she's up for good."
Judy took her aunt's hand, which felt chilly.
"Aunt Barb, we're here. We love you."
Her mother frowned. "Don't wake her. She needs to sleep." The nurse walked to the bed and picked up a white cylinder with a bright green light on one end, which was attached to a covered dispenser on a stalk.
Ladies, this is her pain medication. All she has to do is press this green light. It will dispense morphine every 15 minutes, but not more frequently than that.
She crossed back to an opening in the privacy curtain.
I'm here if you need anything. I'll be back to check on her.
Thank you, Judy and her mother said in unison. Then, when they were alone, silence descended again for a moment.
Judy, her mother said, her tone weary.
She sank into an institutional chair on the other side of the bed. Her makeup had worn off, and her features finally relaxed, as if she had kicked out the emotional jams.
Let go of her hand and sit down. It's going to be a while.
I guess you're right. Judy was hoping to make peace, so she released her aunt's hand, rolled over a stool on wheels, and perched on it uncomfortably.
She doesn't look that good, does she?
Her mother gazed down at Aunt Barb with a slight frown.
She is pale, but it's probably the stress of the procedure, the trauma of it.
I'm sure, but they got all the cancer, so that's wonderful. Judy felt her heart lift, but her mother seemed not to hear her.
I watched a video of it on YouTube. It's not a pretty operation.
Judy recoiled. I'm just glad it was a success.
They have everything on the internet nowadays.
Her mother's gaze remained on Aunt Barb.
You can see medical videos of breast reconstruction, of mastectomies with the flap or without one, same with expanders. Everything you can imagine. Women make their own video blogs, too.
Survivors, that is.
I found it very helpful. You should take a look.
Judy couldn't imagine taking a look.
It's a wealth of information.
Judy didn't reply, realizing that when she and her mother were talking, it was never real conversation, wherein one person replied to the other. It was more like they both took turns filling up the air with words in a series of familial non sequiturs.
We should be quiet so she can sleep, her mother added, though she was the only one talking.
So Judy conceded the obvious, that she might as well work while her aunt was asleep. She leaned over, grabbed her bag, unpacked her laptop, and lost herself in her email for another hour.
Iris? Her aunt whispered out of the blue. Huh? Judy placed the laptop on the floor and rolled her stool over to the bed and clutched the bed rail, and her mother did the same thing on the other side of the bed. It's Delia, Barb. Are you awake?
Iris?
Her aunt whispered again, her eyelids fluttering. Not Iris, Delia, her mother answered, pursing her lips.
Aunt Barb, it's Judy and Mom.
Judy reached for her aunt's hand, which felt warmer. We're here, and you're fine. Your operation was fine.
Iris, her aunt said, more distinctly, and opened her eyes.
Her gaze was unfocused blue, shifting from Judy to her mother, taking them in only vaguely.
Oh, hello. I was thinking of Iris.
Judy squeezed her hand.
We love you, Aunt Barb. We're here for you. Iris was with me. She helped me.
Her aunt's voice trailed off.
She was there with me in the beginning before they put the mask on. I could feel her presence.
Really? Judy asked, surprised. But her mother shot her a look. Judy, please don't encourage this. You'll have her seeing ghosts, for God's sakes.
Her mother picked up a small bottle of water from the bed table and twisted off the cap.
Barb, are you thirsty? Does your throat hurt?
Judy?
Aunt Barb turned her head toward Judy and squeezed her hand, though her grip was weak.
Do you hear me about Iris? I mean, I know she's gone, but she was there. She told me everything was going to be okay. I felt so comforted. Ah, oh, Judy was touched. I bet that was very comforting. It was. And I want to know what happened to her. I want to know. What time is it? Today is Monday, right? Is it?
Yes, it's Monday. Judy checked her watch. It's about 5:30.
Today was the day you were going to find out. You're going to call somebody about Iris.
Judy's mother interjected. Barb, have some water, will you? The nurse told us your throat would be dry. Are you in any pain? Aunt Barb shook her head agitated.
It hurts. My chest.
Judy's mother reached for the white morphine dispenser. Here. You have pain meds, dear. Aunt Barb ignored her, turning to Judy.
Judy, did you call? What did they say?
Judy patted her aunt's hand. You mean about Iris's autopsy? I called earlier today, but they said to call back later, and I didn't get a chance.
Call them. I want you to call them. I want to know. I want to know what happened to Iris. I owe that to her.
Now? Judy asked, off balance. You really want to know that now? Barb, I can't stand to see you in pain. Her mother thrust the morphine cylinder toward Aunt Barb. Please press the button. You'll feel better. This isn't the time to be worrying about Iris. This is the time to be worrying about yourself. Judy added, Aunt Barb, I wonder if they're even there. It's after business hours. Judy's mother pressed the green button for the morphine. Here, let me help. This will make you feel better, calmer. Judy looked over as the clear morphine ran down the tube. Mom, she should do that, not you, don't you think? Her mother raised an eyebrow. Why? I want her to be comfortable.
Call them. Call them. They have to be there.
Her aunt shook her head in confusion, and whether it was the effect of the drugs or she was really concerned, Judy wanted to placate her.
Okay, Aunt Barb, I'll go call them and be right back.
Judy released her aunt's hand, dug in her blazer pocket for her phone, and passed through the opening in the privacy curtain. Signs were posted prohibiting the use of cell phones, so she hurried from the recovery room through a swinging door, past the reception desk and into the waiting area. Most of the seats were filled with people on phones and e-readers, plus reading some actual books. So she scrolled through her recent phone calls, located the number, and pressed call.
Chester County Coroner's Office, answered a young woman's voice. I'm Judy Carrier, and I spoke earlier to the Assistant Deputy Coroner. I'm wondering about the results on the autopsy of Iris Suarez. Would you happen to know if those results are in?
I'll try to find out. Bear with me,
the woman answered, and in the background came the clacking of computer keystrokes.
This isn't usually my job. I'm filling in because we're shorthanded.
I understand.
I see a notation that you called earlier and that you're an attorney with Rosado and D'Annunzio representing the family?
Yes, that's me. Judy wasn't about to bother with technicalities.
Do you have the results?
No, sorry. I don't know how to open the file from the pathologist. I don't have the password. Like I say, this isn't my job.
When can I get the results?
It will have to wait till tomorrow. Call or come by? Are you local?
Kind of.
Sorry about the inconvenience. Everybody's out at a job tonight, a high-profile case. It's very sad. You'll probably see it on the news. One of our local priests, Father Keegan, was killed tonight in a hit and run.
Chapter 28. Judy walked down the glistening hallway, her mind reeling. Hospital staff and families with get-well flowers and Mylar balloons passed her, but she avoided eye contact. Father Keegan had been killed when she had just talked to him this morning. She didn't know how to react or what to do or whether to tell her aunt.
She spotted a restroom down the hall and hustled there. She pressed open the door, crossed to the sink, and splashed cold water on her face, trying to recover. The ladies' room was empty and small, only three sinks and stalls. The chill of the water woke her up, but she couldn't deny the growing realization that something was really wrong. She reached for a paper towel and dried her face, but her thoughts kept churning. Father Keegan's death struck her as too coincidental. The coroner's office had said it was a hit and run, but maybe it wasn't an accident. Maybe it was connected to Iris's death and Daniela's disappearance. Judy tossed the paper towel in the bin and tried to gather her thoughts. She knew she was speculating, but she couldn't help herself. She replayed her conversation with Father Keegan in her mind and couldn't fight an increasing sense of guilt for what happened to him. She leaned against the white tile wall, closing her eyes in pain. She had told the priest that Iris was involved in wrongdoing. He hadn't believed her. He'd found it inconceivable. What if he had started to dig and one of the conspirators had found out? Would they kill him to stop him from digging further? Was it the same people who had attacked her last night? What was going on? Judy slid her phone from her pocket and pressed favorites. The call rang twice, and she said, "Mary, do you have a minute?" "What's the matter?" Mary asked, alarmed. "Is Aunt Barb okay?" "She's fine, but I just found out that Father Keegan is dead in a hit and run." "The priest? Oh, no," Mary moaned. "I feel so terrible." Tears came to Judy's eyes. "It's my fault. I didn't know. I didn't think." "What are you talking about? How can it be your fault?" "I told him about the money today and that I thought Iris was dealing drugs. He didn't think it was true. What if he started digging and they killed him?" "That's possible, but that doesn't mean it's your fault." "Why not?" Judy asked miserably. "I told him about it. If he wanted to get to the bottom of it, it was because of our conversation." "No, you are not responsible for that. Whoever hit him was responsible for that, whether it was an accident or not. Why do you think it's not an accident? Have you spoken to the police?" "No, the coroner. But it just seems too coincidental. Think of the chain of events. Iris's death, finding the money, my getting attacked, and Iris's apartment was ransacked last night, too." "It was?" "Yes, right before we were attacked. That's what Father Keegan called to tell me about. Somebody is looking for that money."
"You think?"
"Yes. I think that Father Keegan started asking around after he spoke to me, and somehow, at the end of the day, he ended up..." Judy couldn't bring herself to say the words. "Oh, my God. This is terrible. It could have been murder."
"You don't know that yet. You don't have any real evidence or facts."
"Agree. It's circumstantial, but it's compelling." "I have to admit it is. And we know that every hit and run isn't necessarily an accident." Mary's tone turned grave, and Judy remembered that Mary's first husband was murdered almost the same way, struck by a car years ago while he was riding his bicycle on West River Drive.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring that up."
"No, honey, it's okay," Mary added quickly. "So where are you now? What are you going to do?"
"I'm at the hospital. Should I tell my aunt? I didn't tell her about Iris's apartment being broken into. My mother didn't want me to."
"I get that, and I'd hold off for now. Is she okay?"
"She has to be going through hell."
"The surgery went fine, and she's coming around." Judy made a gut decision. "I don't think I'll tell her yet. But she's going to want to know the autopsy results on Iris, and I don't have those yet. So tell her that, but not about the priest."
"Agree."
Judy felt reassured that she and Mary were on the same page. "She'll be stronger tomorrow, and you'll know more."
"I hope so."
Judy straightened up with a final sniffle.
I better go back now. You need anything? I can come down there. I'm home, ordering takeout.
Judy hadn't eaten but didn't feel hungry.
No, thanks. I'm fine.
And by the way, the money's safe in a bank.
Good.
Keep me posted.
Love you.
Love you too.
Bye.
Judy pressed N to hang up, slipped the phone back into her jacket, and checked her reflection on the way out. The strain showed on her face, and her blue dressed-up-for-deposition suit was rumpled, but she tried to get it together as she left the bathroom. She hit the hallway and hurried back to the recovery room, where she pushed the privacy curtain aside to find her mother helping her aunt sip some water from a bottle.
"What did you find out?"
her aunt asked after her mother moved the bottle.
"So far, not much."
Judy managed a smile, crossing to her aunt's bedside.
"I couldn't find the right person to talk to."
"How do you feel?"
"Better,"
her aunt answered, though the corners of her mouth turned down.
"There's pain, but I'm thinking more clearly."
"What do you mean you couldn't find the right person?"
"I mean the deputy assistant coroner wasn't there, and the young woman I spoke with didn't know how to open the report."
Judy went with a half-truth, since she was the worst liar in the Bar Association.
"So there's a report, but they couldn't open it?"
"Evidently. I'll try again tomorrow."
"Isn't there someone else you can call? I won't sleep until I know what happened to her."
Judy's mother snorted, easing back into her chair. "After that morphine, you'll be asleep in 10 minutes. Judy started to get another idea. "I suppose I could make a few more calls, but it would be easier to do from the office. They're not big fans of cell phones here. The sign says it interferes with the machines." Aunt Barb blinked.
"So go to the office. I'd love it if you can find out those results, and I know you have work to do. Feel free to go, really."
Judy's mother nodded. "Honestly, honey, I can handle everything here. The nurse was just in and said they're going to move her to a room. I'll stay and get her situated. And by then, visiting hours will be over. They end at 8 o'clock. Judy looked from her aunt to her mother, her heart beginning to beat with anticipation. "You sure you don't need me here to help?" Aunt Barb smiled wanly.
"You can help me the most by getting the coroner's report."
Her mother flashed a smile that looked oddly relieved. "You can help me the most by getting out of my hair." "Very funny," Judy said, faking a smile. She had better things to do than fight with her mother. An hour and a half later, Judy was getting out of her car, having found a parking space in the municipal lot across from the Kennett Square police station. She felt bad about lying to her mother and aunt, but she'd had no intention of going into the office. She was burning to find out what happened to Father Keegan, having driven here with her brain on fire, convincing herself of a connection between Iris's and the priest's deaths. She hoped that she could convince the police that she was right, or at least to consider the possibility and investigate her theory. Detective Boone had given her his business card, and she tried to call him on the way over, but there had been no answer, and the message had gone to voicemail. Judy walked through the parking lot, heading for the police station, which was completely unassuming. It bore no sign except for a small navy blue keystone, which was unlighted and therefore unreadable in the darkness. Only a single light over its paneled front door illuminated the small, red brick building that could have passed for a modest single-story house situated between a low-rise Tudor apartment building and a stop-time laundromat with a misspelled sign that read LAUNDERMAT. A small parking lot around the right side of the station house held 5 police cruisers, white with a black stripe, and 1 all-black car, unmarked. Judy approached the paved entrance in front of the station, which buzzed with activity. Men in suits and brown-uniformed police stood outside, talking or smoking in groups,
and neighbors filled the sidewalk gawking at TV reporters who were positioning themselves in calcium-white circles of Klieg lights. Boxy news vans with local TV logos lined the curb, their black, rubbery wires making tripping hazards on the sidewalk and their mobile microwave towers dwarfing the colonial row houses on the quaint side streets. Judy made her way through the crowd to the front door, then opened it onto a small square waiting room full of personnel, reporters, and men in suits. To her left was a closed door with a sign that read Mayor's Office, and to her right were blue padded chairs where reporters and cameramen sat drinking covered cups of coffee, cameras on their laps. She walked past them, doing a double take when she spotted on the wall a signed lithograph from one of the Wyatts, the famed painting family who lived in nearby Brandywine. The art alone qualified Kennett Squares as one of the nicest station houses she'd ever seen, but it also had a thick lapis blue rug, eggshell white walls, and one of exposed brick, in which was embedded a rectangular window of glass. Judy went to the window and introduced herself to a middle-aged woman with bright blue eyes and a warm professional smile, then said, "I'd like to speak with Detective Boone in connection with the death tonight of Father Keegan." "Is he expecting you?" the woman asked brightly. She wore her light brown hair in a bun and had on an orange T-shirt with Kennett Square Police printed on the breast pocket with khaki pants. "No, but I left a phone message." "Is this a tip?" "Because he's very busy tonight." The woman shook her head sadly. "It's a terrible loss." "I do have information that I believe can help him. He knows me because he's been working on a case involving my aunt, Barb Moyer." "Oh my, I know who you are." The woman's eyes registered recognition. "You're the woman who was assaulted last night, aren't you?" "Yes," Judy answered, moving her hair aside to show her goose egg. "This is me, the real thing." "Go to your left and I'll buzz you in the door," the woman said, hurrying off. Chapter 29. "We're meeting in here?" Judy asked, following Detective Boone, who was unlocking the door to the mayor's office. "Won't the mayor mind?" "This is Kennett Square, not New York City." Detective Boone led her inside a small, completely empty office, lined with tasteful walnut bookshelves, full of leather-bound volumes of law books and black plastic binders. A clean mahogany desk, an old-school courtroom chair, sat in the far corner next to the American flag, and nearest the door was a modern round conference table, also of walnut, with three matching chairs. "Where's the mayor?" "It's after hours." Detective Boone tugged out one of the chairs and gestured to Judy to sit down. "Please." "Thanks." Judy sat down, getting her bearings. "I thought we'd meet in the squad room like they do in Philadelphia." "Technically, it's not my squad room." Detective Boone sat down in the chair opposite her. "The county detective's office is in Westchester. When we're on a job, like tonight, we're squatters. How's that noggin of yours?" "Fine, but I'm so sorry to hear about Father Keegan." "Me too. He was a great guy. It's a real blow to the community." Detective Boone slid a ballpoint pen from his pocket, along with his skinny spiral notebook. He looked the same as he had last night, his close-set blue eyes intense and concerned behind his wire-rimmed glasses, his sandy brown hair in its short professional cut, and he had on another boxy dark suit with a pattern tie. "Do you have something for me on Keegan? They said you had a tip." "I spoke to him this morning, on the phone. He called me because he'd read that I was assaulted and he wanted to tell me that Iris's apartment had been broken into and ransacked. Did you know about that?"
"No."
Detective Boone flipped open the cardboard top to his notebook.
"Anybody assaulted or injured?"
"No, nobody was home."
"Anything taken?"
Detective Boone started taking notes. "Nothing of value.
I think they were looking for the money that Iris had stashed in my aunt's house.
Judy wanted to get to the point. Detective, I believe that Father Keegan's death is linked to Iris Suarez's. I think they were both murdered.
What are you talking about?
Detective Boone frowned, looking up from his note-taking. Father Keegan was a hit-and-run accident.
Can you explain to me how it happened?
Detective Boone hesitated.
I'll tell you what's public record. He was struck from behind, along the curve, walking to his car. It's very dangerous there. There's no sidewalk. It happened at about 5:15, and it was dark. The car was driving north, so he couldn't have seen him when it turned the corner.
Judy tried to visualize the scene, though she had never been there, and it tugged at her heart to imagine the priest in the last minutes of his life, not knowing that a deadly car was bearing down on him. Still, she reminded herself not to be emotional. If she really wanted to convince the detective of anything, she had to keep her wits about her. She asked, "What was he doing there, by the side of the road?"
"There's a little restaurant called Jamie's. He was walking from the restaurant to his car, which was parked in the side lot."
"Where's the restaurant?"
"On Warm Spring Road, number 870, I believe. It's at the curve."
Judy made a mental note. "What's the cross street?"
"Closest one is Buck and Doe."
"That's a street name?"
"Yes, city girl."
Detective Boone almost smiled. "Did anybody see anything, like in any of the surrounding stores or houses?"
"There aren't any. It's on the outskirts of town."
"Another remote stretch? Why am I not surprised?" Judy felt more convinced than ever now that she was getting the facts. "Was he alone?"
"Yes. He eats there every night. The early bird special, soup and sandwich."
Judy thought a minute. "How do you know that? From asking around?"
"Of course, yes."
"So it was generally known?"
"Everybody knew about it in the parish. He even used to meet with parishioners there. They would seek him out. I heard that from more than one person."
"It was that well established a routine?"
"Most of us are creatures of habit. That doesn't mean anything."
Detective Boone cocked his head.
"We figure it was a drunk driver. We get a lot of that out here. Country life can be boring for kids and the like. And if they're undocumented, they're going to keep driving. Either way, they won't get away with it. We're all over it."
He gestured toward the waiting room.
"But let's go back a minute. When was Iris's apartment burglarized?"
"Last night, at about 6 o'clock, right before I was attacked at my aunt's house. I think the bad guys, whoever they are looking for the money. They went to her apartment, then they went to my aunt's."
"The address we have, on Point Breeze?"
"Yes."
"Were there any witnesses?"
"Not that I know of, but you have to follow up with that."
"We will, but it's going through the motions. They're not going to tell us anything, just like they didn't report it."
"But you will try anyway, won't you?"
"Of course."
"What about Iris's phone? Did you follow up with that, about the call she got?"
"Yes, but we can't find the phone. The police at the scene didn't bag one, neither did the coroner."
Judy blinked.
"She had one. I saw it." "Do you know for a fact that she had it on her?"
"No, but why wouldn't she?"
Judy thought about it.
"Whoever killed her took it."
"I'll keep investigating." Detective Boone returned to his note-taking. "What about the money? What did you decide to do with it?"
"It's safely in a bank right now." Judy had to get back on track. "I called the coroner to find out the autopsy results on Iris, but I couldn't because they were all working on the Father Keegan case. But if it turns out that she died of unnatural causes..."
"Excuse me, I'm not following." Detective Boone held up a hammy hand with the pen. "What does Father Keegan have to do with Iris? I'm assuming she was a parishioner. But what of it? Most of the Mexicans in the county belong to that church or St. Agnes."
"When I spoke to him this morning, I told him about the cash in my aunt's house and that I thought that Iris was in a drug ring. He knew her very well and he refused to believe that she would be involved with anything illegal."
Judy felt her chest tighten and another wave of guilt washed over her. but she tried to stay on point. I am betting that after he hung up, he tried to get to the bottom of it. Maybe he started asking questions about her death or about drug dealing in the community, and whoever is selling the drugs or whatever got wind of it and killed him to silence him. This is speculation, Detective Boone said, but his wrinkled forehead showed that he was mulling it over. It's not speculation. It's circumstantial, and there's a difference. Judy found her bearings now that she'd learned the facts about how the priest had died. If Father Keegan had a routine of going to this restaurant, and the bad guys heard that he was digging around, then they could very easily predict where he'd be, right? Detective Boone didn't reply, but met her eye and ceased his note-taking. It gets dark early this time of year. If they know generally what time he leaves the restaurant, they could plan for it and run him over. It would look like a hit and run, but it could really be murder. Judy leaned forward, encouraged by his interest. What do you think? That's a possibility, Detective Boone answered after a moment. It certainly is. Between what I know and what you know, if we work together, we can figure this thing out. Detective Boone lifted an eyebrow. Don't get the wrong idea here. I'm listening to you, but I am not working with you. Okay, I understand. Judy dialed back her enthusiasm. The other possibility is that Father Keegan's death was an accident, and Iris Juarez died of natural causes. You call this circumstantial, but I think it's speculation. And either way, none of it is supported by any evidence or facts. Detective Boone picked up his notepad and abruptly rose to his feet. Excuse me for 5 minutes. Sure, Judy answered, surprised. Where are you going? Be right back, Detective Boone answered, heading for the door. He opened it, letting in noise and chatter from the waiting room, then closed it behind him. Judy sat back in her chair, feeling her heart begin to thump. The more she thought about it, the more her theory made sense, though she had no idea how to go about proving it. She felt driven to find out what had really happened to Father Keegan, not only to bring his killers to justice, but to help her redeem herself for his death. She felt her throat tighten with emotion, but swallowed hard to keep it at bay. Judy reflexively pulled out her phone to check her text and email on lawyer autopilot. There was no new text from Frank, and she read through her incoming email, but there was nothing important from any of her clients or from opposing counsel like Rick Killen. She'd have to catch up with their other cases at some point, but she couldn't begin to think about that now. She scrolled to the phone function to call her mother and check on Aunt Barb. The call went to voicemail after one ring, but she didn't leave a message. Suddenly the door to the office opened, letting in a burst of crowd noise as Detective Boone entered the room carrying a sheaf of papers, but his demeanor had changed. His expression had snapped back into its official mask. His blue-eyed gaze had cooled, and his thin lips formed an unsmiling, if professional, line. You want facts? I have facts. What? Judy asked, intrigued. Iris Juarez died of natural causes. She had a heart attack. This is the pathologist's report. Detective Boone set down the sheaf of papers on the conference table. I spoke with him, and he emailed me a copy of his findings. Judy felt dumbfounded as she slid the papers over. Her eye shot to the top line, which had a blank for cause of death, and stated myocardial infarction. Oh, no. In law enforcement, we consider this good news. A natural death is better than murder, correct? Detective Boone walked around the table, returned to his chair, and sat down, crossing his legs. I can't believe this. Judy skimmed the report, which seemed like a thorough autopsy report, typical in every way. I think this should put your theory to rest on Father Keegan as well. I don't get it, Judy said, stumped. She flipped through the report
until she reached the section for internal examination of organs. And the description of Iris's heart read that its arteries showed evidence of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, ASCVD. He said that there's a real problem in the undocumented community because they don't get the medical care they need to control heart disease and hypertension. Did they find any drugs in her system? Judy flipped to the back of the report, where the toxicological screens were usually attached as an appendix, but there wasn't one. The tox screen takes 2 to 3 weeks to come in, and it will show if there was alcohol or drugs in her system. What about legal drugs? The basic covers only illegal drugs, not legal ones. Judy looked up. Can we test her now for legal drugs? Do they keep the blood? How does that work? An expanded takes longer, and it doesn't happen unless a detective or the pathologist believes it's in order. He didn't request it. Would you request it? No. Detective Boone shook his head. Iris Juarez died a natural death. She wasn't the victim of a homicide. You're a lawyer. You know that police departments are subject to budget constraints. If I authorize expenditures on Juarez, then I won't have it in a case where I have evidence of a suspicious death. How much does it cost? Basic is $120. Expanded is $160. Listen, if it's just a question of cost, I'll pay for it myself. I'd like to request the coroner to do a screen of her blood for legal or prescription drugs and expand it. How do I do that? You have to get in touch with the coroner's office tomorrow. They may or may not do it. Detective Boone shook his head. But what is it exactly you're hoping to find? Detective, I admit, I don't know what I'm looking for. If I did, I wouldn't be looking for it. Maybe abuse of prescription medication, counterfeit medication, something like that. Point of information? What comes in here from Mexico isn't prescription meds or counterfeits. It's heroin. And it doesn't originate in Mexico, but comes through it. Because it's easier to smuggle heroin into Mexico than the States. Generally, the dealers pay mules to carry it up north for distribution and sale. Judy couldn't picture Iris as a heroin smuggler or dealer, but something still stunk to high heaven. Do you have a heroin problem in the county? No more than elsewhere in the state, to my knowledge. Detective Boone paused. If the pathologist had found trace evidence of heroin on her hands or fingers, it'd be different, but he didn't. Judy checked the report, flipping to the external examination of Iris's hands, which read, broken fingernails on right index and right middle finger, with superficial scrapes on finger pads. Look at this. The broken fingernails. How did she get those? She could have done that a number of ways, none of which is suspicious at all. In a struggle? There weren't any signs of any struggle or defensive wounds of any kind. Judy tried another tack. What about heroin on the money? How do I get the money tested? I believe there are private labs that do that. Check online. Judy gathered the autopsy report in case her aunt wanted to see it. What about the 50 grand, the assault on me and Father Keegan? How do you explain it? Rest assured, we're investigating the hit and run and will continue to do so. Father Keegan meant a great deal to us, and we will give him 100% of our efforts. As for the money, Detective Boone shrugged mildly. Granted, I can't explain it. But there's no crime that has been committed, and even if there were, it's a matter for the Kennett Square Police. They have only 12 officers full-time, so they work closely together. They're all aware of what happened at your aunt's house. That's how you got past the front desk to me tonight, isn't it? Yes, Judy had to concede. Trust me, it's the talk of the squad room. Leave it to them. They're small town, but they're professional. Don't underestimate them just because they're not big city. Detective Boone rose, brushing down his slacks.
If you observe anything further, or God forbid, are a victim of another attack, you need to call them.
I appreciate your time, but I just can't accept this. Not yet, anyway.
Judy rose, feeling as if she had failed Father Keegan, Iris, and her aunt. Even herself.
Maybe if the only thing that happened was that Iris had a heart attack, I would believe it. But taken as a whole, I'm just not buying that it's all innocent.
Good night. Detective Boone walked to the doorway, put his hand on the doorknob, and opened the door. If there's anything you need to know, we will contact you.
Thank you, Judy said miserably, but she was already thinking of her next move.
Chapter 30. Judy pulled over and let the engine idle across the street from Jamie's restaurant, unable to get closer because the area had been cordoned off with parked cruisers, flares, and sawhorses. Uniformed police and other personnel gathered in groups inside the perimeter, and reporters clustered on the outside. A chubby traffic cop stood with an orange flashlight, ready to direct traffic around the scene, though the only car was Judy's. The coroner's van must have already gone, and a police truck was towing away an old blue minivan, presumably Father Keegan's. Judy felt a pang at the sight, thinking how awful it must have been for the priest to die this way, by the side of the road in shock and pain. She felt a new wave of guilt and grief, and being there felt like an awful replay of Saturday night, when Iris had been found in her car. Judy cut the ignition and got out of the car to look around. The air was cold, and Warm Springs Road would have been pitch black except for the lights from the police vehicles. She surveyed the street, which was just as she had pictured it, completely deserted and lined by tangled underbrush and thick, dark woods on both sides, with no houses or shops. It was barely wide enough to accommodate two lanes, which ran in different directions and curved dramatically around the restaurant. A small converted house of white clapboard that couldn't have held more than eight tables. Light came from inside the restaurant, and she could see police personnel milling at the counter. Judy walked along the road toward the restaurant, and now that she could see the lay of the land, it was easy to reconstruct how Father Keegan could have been killed. The restaurant was situated at the elbow of the curve, and a car driving past could have targeted someone walking towards its parking lot, with their back turned. There was neither a curb nor a shoulder, just some gravel, and nothing would have protected the priest from a driver cutting the corner, intentionally or not. Judy hurried across the street to the perimeter, but noticed she had drawn the attention of the traffic cop, who lumbered toward her, waving his orange flashlight. She pretended not to see him, turned away, and hustled in the opposite direction along the perimeter. When she got closer to the opposite side of the street, she could see in the flickering of the flares that several bouquets of flowers had been left there, a sight that broke her heart.
Miss, please don't go back there, the traffic cop called, catching up with her. Miss, excuse me.
Officer, I just wanted to see. Judy gestured at the flowers, and the chubby face of the traffic cop softened under his cap.
Condolences, but you can't be leaving your car where you did, miss.
The traffic cop waved his flashlight toward her car.
Please move it out.
Can't I just take a minute and look around?
No, you may not. You're creating a traffic hazard.
The traffic cop waved her off again.
You want to pay your respects? You'd be better advised to do that in daytime when it's safer, or to head on over to the church tonight. I hear there's plenty of folks there doing the same thing.
Good idea. Thanks, officer, Judy said, meaning it. She turned around and jogged toward her car, wondering why she hadn't thought of it herself. Half an hour later, she was slipping into the back pew of the beautiful Madre de Dios Church, near where she had sat just yesterday morning when she had come to Mass with her aunt. The lovely altar with its simple crucifix and graceful marble statuary was vacant now. It seemed impossible to fathom that Father Keegan had conducted that very Mass and shown such kindness to her and her aunt, as well as comfort to his congregation. And now he was no longer here.
Tears came to Judy's eyes, but she didn't bother to blink them away, because she felt as if she belonged here for the first time. It was emotion that connected her to the congregation, and it was her heart that connected her to all of the other hearts in the church. Grieving families filled the pews, their expressions stricken and their heads bowed, sniffling as they knelt with rosary beads hanging between their fingers, some praying silently and others whispering their prayers in Spanish or English. Women lit candles in front of a statue of the Virgin of Guadalupe near the altar, and a young priest went from one parishioner to the next, putting an arm around them and engaging them in quiet conversation. Judy watched him, wishing again she had some sort of religion, because she could see before her eyes the power the priest had to comfort people and to ease their pain. The only thing she believed in was love, and that came close to a spiritual belief, maybe as close as she would ever get. The second thing she knew that she believed in was the law, and she felt her emotions slip into default mode, anger at the injustice of a crime as heinous as murder, especially if Father Keegan, a man of goodwill and open heart. She couldn't stay out of it, no matter what Detective Boone had said.